Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and today my guest is Linda Spaulding. Her new novel, A Reckoning, has been published by Pantheon Books. I'm very deeply affected by this book. The year is 1855. It's 10 years before the official declaration of the Civil War. It takes place in one of the southern corners of the state of Virginia. And it's about something that I had no idea of, that there were people leaving Virginia, in a sense, in order to get away from the crisis of conscience that was occurring within the South prior to the Civil War. And what we're going to watch is an entire cast of characters, the characters of this novel, with one major exception, going in a wagon train west. This is a traveling west novel from the South. Is this historically the case?
Michael, it is. It is absolutely historically the case. In fact, it's pretty much based on family stories and records on my father's side of the family.
Was your father a minister?
No, but my great-great-grandfather was. And he was what they called a circuit-riding preacher. And I think they were called that because they rode around on horseback and, you know, threw up tents and gave revival meetings and things like that. But they were, you know, they were Methodists for the most part, and fervent.
Very fervent. The first sermon we hear, which is a invitation to the congregation to dance and celebrate and writhe, is a retelling of the story of the angel, Jacob's ladder, yes?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
These are the angels climbing up and down Jacob's ladder. They will rename Jacob, yes? They will rename him as Israel. He will become the spokesperson for the people of Israel. And he grabs the angel and won't let go until he gets a blessing from the angel.
Absolutely right. Yep.
And in this book, as this sermon from, of course, the Old Testament is given, and as the people are starting to respond bodily to the request that they grab and hold on to the angel, that they demand that they be blessed, that an angel is coming.
And that they'd better deserve it.
And that they better deserve the blessing, yes.
Mm-hmm.
The minister's son is standing under a tree where a man wearing a hat with feathers arrives. We don't know really in this book if he is the angel, if the Civil War will be the angel, but a change and a renaming is going to occur in this book. This is a minister's family. His brother has squandered the family's property and estate before dying. So the minister is sending all of his people, his second wife, his son, the son we just mentioned, he's sending them off They're building Conestoga wagons. We're watching a westward track. If I'm not mistaken, the Kentucky Territory has opened up, yes?
I think not legally yet.
Uh-huh.
I may be foggy on that. Because, yes, it probably had opened by then, yes. I know that when the family settled, it had not, and it was sort of the very tipping edge of the U.S. when you settled in Virginia.
Yes.
You know, that was the end of it.
I think of heading west as being entirely separate from the things that caused the Civil War. And what this book is telling me is that the westward movement is in a way related to the Underground Railroad and subsequent escapes. The minister father provides letters of freedom to all of the slaves and servants who are traveling. They're not only black people, there are Native Americans as well who have been working for this family on the land. What does your family's records, what did you learn? What were you shown? How did this book begin?
Well, let me just say, just to remind you, that all those Southerners were jumping into Missouri and over the line into Kansas in order to make sure that Kansas would be a Southern slave state. So it was really a hotbed even before the Civil War. I mean, that's really where it all started with John Brown and so forth. So remember that some of those people who were trekking out there were taking their beliefs with them. Some of them were taking slaves with them, not all. And that wagon train, I think we didn't have slaves traveling, but that was one of the things that happened, right? And then you have the New Englanders, the Yankees coming down from north to bring their abolitionist views to Kansas, not to Missouri. So that was part of the background. And in terms of my family, I found out as a child, A, that we were slave owners, which absolutely appalled me since my father was essentially a civil rights lawyer. And more, perhaps more interestingly to me at a young age, that when my great-great-grandfather as a boy had come on that trek, he'd had a pet bear. And I was very concerned about the bear from an early age. And I kept asking about the bear. I asked about the slaves too. What happened? And my father would say, oh, it was fine. We gave everyone a mule and off they went. Which of course is not a very accurate telling.
It's not an answer.
You don't just send someone off into the unknown with a letter of manumission and expect that they are going to survive happily. But the bear, of course, intrigued me. And I kept saying, what happened to the bear? So all of that led to a kind of lifelong obsession with this story.
When we meet the family leaving in their Conestoga wagons in a huge wagon train, the boy, his name is Martin, is 13 years old, and he's decided to bring the bear with him. The bear is a cub. Martin is our hero, our protagonist, really. And people are saying to his mother, is he stupid? Why is he bringing the bear with him? I mean, this is not easy to begin with.
Right.
Why is he bringing along the bear? Now, I guess there are two answers to this. One within the novel and one within your family. Why did he bring along the bear?
Well, I think he brought along the bear probably in opposition to his father, who had decided at the last minute not, in fact, to come along on the wagon train journey. And that was another big mystery in our family. What in the world was he doing for that time that he held back, stayed back, having lost everything? On the home front, why would he stay back? Was he ashamed? Did he have some ulterior motive? So I think Martin is already opposing his father. And part of this story has to do with what kind of, I think, what kind of manhood you choose to live in your life. Martin has to decide all that on this trip.
I'm talking to Linda Spaulding about her novel, A Reckoning, which is published by Pantheon. This is a novel of secrets. And among the many things we don't know is who is whose parent,
mm-hmm.
who parented whom. This is a period of history and scandal and shame and disgrace where white families fathered children on black women. Black women hid those babies. Sometimes those babies were sold. This is the nightmare of history that we witness before the people enacting understood or came to understand that it was a nightmare. On the road, this Martin, 13 years old, what is he going to do? He has to learn to cook. Men are altering what is perceived as their manliness.
Absolutely.
These are children who prided themselves on being waited on hand and foot.
Well, and the women, the same thing. The women who had always had servants are set off on this wagon train without any and are suddenly told to fix meals on the ground over a fire. And you know, where do you go to pee? And how much privacy do you get to have? And do you ever bathe? And all of that stuff that a civilized Southern lady expected, those were all... Now, absent.
It's as if in this book, A Reckoning, by my guest Linda Spaulding, we're reading a counter-American history of the people who leave their homes, leave the plantation, have the plantation taken over by the bank to whom money is owed. That these were not foundations at all, that many, certainly the characters in this book, had nothing to fall back on. Now, did you know when you started how intricate these involvements are?
No, I didn't. And I mean, I had to do some research. I was always nervous about writing about the Underground Railroad, but then I found this wonderful character who exists in time named Alexander Ross, who was a Canadian abolitionist who did go down into the South and tell plantation owners that he was an ornithologist and he wanted to study the birds in their fields and so forth. So that was fun. I had that to work with. And I had some records about the wagon train. I knew what boats they sailed on. Or traveled on, I should say. They weren't sailboats. They were steamboats. So I didn't, for example, know that wagon trains were customarily put on to steamboats to cross the state of Missouri. What a wonderful, incredible piece of little fact that was. You know, these boats that were packed with Conestoga wagons, with covered wagons, with cows and pigs and geese and whatever. That was a great, it was a lot of fun.
The minister's brother, who's squandered the family's fortune, and the minister both love and have had children by the same woman.
Right.
Secretly. The 13-year-old boy has heard about these relations. He's overheard.
Mm-hmm.
He's eavesdropped on these relations in the barn. But he doesn't know that it's both brothers. And he and his own brother are in rival relationships as well. So what we're discovering in this book of Reckoning is that everything by the end of this book will have to be parsed. That the whole book is about what happens when people refuse moral responsibilities that will ultimately shape the history of
this
the Americas.
Country.
Exactly.
This, absolutely. And of all of us. I mean, all of these things have trickled down through our DNA, through our consciousness, through our stories into the present day, and they still afflict us.
Now, Alice Walker once looked at me very intensely. I had used the word slaves, brought slaves over from Africa. And she said, "Michael, they were not slaves in Africa. They were people. They were tribes people. This idea that they were slaves did not come until they arrived in America. And it was the failure of Americans to see them as anything but slaves." And so even in Linda Spaulding's book, the abolitionists think that they're freeing slaves as
right.
opposed to restoring human beings, people, to their rights. And this makes the writing a very complex thing indeed, because we can't leave out the word slave as much as we're appalled
by the word.
By the word.
I think there's a sentence in the book where Alexander Ross, where I say that Alexander Ross hated the slaver more than he loved the slave. And I think that probably was the emotional intensity of a lot of abolitionists, that they were not necessarily people who loved the oppressed, but they were self-righteous. They thought that, you know, right must be done. And therefore they hated the slaver, or they wanted to reform the slaver.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Linda Spaulding about her book, A Reckoning. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Linda Spaulding about her new book, A Reckoning, set in 1855. Follows an escaped slave's journey to freedom with the help of the family who he escaped from. Now that's a magnificent paradox as well, too. And what we're encountering in this book is that nothing that one expects is true. In order to tell the story, a century has to have passed. I would say this book could not have been written in the 1960s or the 1950s or the 1940s. We're only beginning to have enough sense of history, morality, chronicle, and that our own current events are starting to make us see that not just black people, but black people and white people must tell these stories. If in Linda's case, you're telling on your family, aren't you?
I'm telling on them.
Wow.
For sure.
Yes.
But I don't know. Don't you feel implicated in your ancestral sort of line in things that happened, or do you not? I don't know.
In every imaginable way.
Yes.
In every imaginable way. I'm talking, you know, I'm of Russian Jewish descent, but you would think, oh, how fortunate for you. You were not there in Germany where right. the monstrosities took place, but the gulags were more monstrous.
More, indeed.
And so it's always the sense...
And we inherit that.
I have never learned the whole story.
Right.
It's an awful story, and I have been exposed to it only by relatives who were willing to tell it. I mean, let's face it, Linda, for the longest time, you know, we've recently celebrated the anniversary, the horrifying anniversary of the Armenian genocide. So many people were alive at this time and never told their grandchildren about what happened.
Was it shame or was it
horror?
Protecting the child? What was that about?
This is not good for children. You don't talk about, if you were to ask my grandmother, mm-hmm. you don't talk about these things to children, in front of children.
Give them nightmares.
Worse than that, you see, I don't know. It is said that my grandfather committed suicide, but I don't know. And there's no finding out because that whole generation has now passed away. We lose the past when we become unwilling to tell the stories.
And we also forgive things that perhaps are unforgivable and that do need to be reckoned with. I think that's, you know, important, that we not just hush everything up and make it all nice.
We have to tell the stories, Linda. But in your case, as you said, your father was a civil rights lawyer. He can't possibly love these stories being told.
He did not want to talk about it. We gave them each a mule, and that's enough.
That's what he said.
Well, yeah. Everything was okay. You know, we made up for whatever. I don't know. I mean, I was baffled at the age of 10. I'm still baffled.
Now, is baffled enough?
Well, when you're 10, baffled is probably enough.
When you're 10, but you've gone beyond baffled.
I have gone, yes.
You've written a book.
Yes.
You've written a book in which every member of the cast of characters, white, black, Native American, has a story to tell about needing to get away from a system that was ultimately imprisoning every one of the characters.
Every one of them. Mm-hmm.
Now, it's okay to write a book in which there are no heroes, but how do you write a book in which there are only villains?
You write a book in which everyone is both. Which is, I don't know, I just had a wonderful lesson about the St. Matthew's Passion by Bach, in which I was told that the point of it is that every character in that oratorio is both, that we all are both sinners and angels, right? I mean, we carry, you know, we can't be one thing or the other. And I think that's a really important thing to think about. Particularly when we have ancestors that have shamed us in the present day.
And our sense of shame, what do you think, this is such an unanswerable question, but what do you think we do about this horrible history? What can we do?
I think we'd better work pretty darned hard fast. I figure we have maybe a generation to get this smoothed out. I mean, I'm talking about the racial struggles, the incomprehension of other people's points of view. And I look around, I look at my grandchildren and I think, okay, maybe there's hope. You know, maybe these kids from Florida who are bringing everyone together in D.C. to march, that's a good thing, right? And it's everyone who's marching. But I've been through that. I was through it in the 60s and the 70s, and we have not smoothed it out. We are in perhaps worse state.
Well, that's the question, it seems to me. When you say smoothed it out, it sounds like you're saying make it okay.
Cover it over?
Yeah. And I think we're not talking really about smoothing it out. I think we're talking about exposing the roughness of the surface in every detail. And that's what you do in this novel. You make a world in which it's not okay. This family and its doings, they are being revealed seriatim, one after another, until we can hardly believe that this family exists. They are so inclined to smooth it over.
So I chose the wrong word as the descendant. Yes, no, I understand. I think you're right. We don't really want to smooth it over, but I think smoothing out the edges would be helpful so that everyone isn't screaming at everyone else. And if we could actually begin to empathize, begin to see other points of view, particularly here, where, as we know, we're so polarized on all kinds of grounds. I don't know. I think that's what the novel's supposed to do. I think that's the job.
I've been talking with Linda Spaulding about her most recent novel, A Reckoning. Thank you very much,
Thank
Linda.
You, Michael. It's lovely to be here again.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Michelle Escobar. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, Sean Sullivan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Mary Gateskill is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.